Let's see what the stew has for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by awesome Patreon backers like the jaunty Jack Evans, the judicious Jen Pixel State Gange, and the mad wizard himself, Sean Merwin. Today we have JT, Senda, and myself, Ange, and we're going to talk about figuring out how to run games from the book alone. You've never played it before, but you're still going to run it. Before we dive into that main topic, though, let's ask our Get to Know a Gnome question. Since we're going to talk about game books, tell me about a game that you had absolutely no idea what it was, but you wanted to play it based on the cover or artwork inside alone. JT, why don't we start with you?
Sure thing. So I still have the book, which amazes me because it's from 1981, and it's called Fantasy Wargaming. Well, like it says, it's a fantasy-based role-playing game that takes some elements of tabletop wargaming into it. The reason I picked it based on the cover alone is that I was a member of the Science Fiction Book Club way, way, way back in the day. And of course, all you had was the cover and maybe a paragraph, if that, of a blurb about what the book was about in their catalog. And this was way before internet and Amazon and reviews and all that. So you're kind of picking books blind. And I saw the cover of this thing. I had been role-playing for about a year when I came across this in their catalog and just loved the cover. It's got an old dude reading a book, and then right behind him is another book that's open. And pouring forth out of this open book behind the guy are, well, it looks to be snakes and a demon with the angelic wings. And it's just, I don't know, the artwork just mesmerized me. And I was like, oh, that's got to be great. So I added it to my monthly selection of please send me these books, and got it, dove into it, and kind of went from there. I've actually never run the game, even though I've owned it for however many decades, because quite honestly, it's not a good role-playing game, which made me sad.
How about you, Senda?
It's actually the very first role-playing game I ever encountered before I actually knew what a role-playing game was. So I was also reading tons of sci-fi and fantasy, and I was super obsessed with Margaret Rice and Tracy Hickman, like when you're growing up and you're like, holy cow, Dragonlance. So I was like, holy cow, this Dark Sword series, like this trilogy is amazing, right? And then I was in a used bookstore one day and I picked up this book that said Dark Sword Adventures on it. And I was like, holy cow, there's another book in this series I didn't know about, because it is a paperback and it is the same thickness as all the novels and everything. And it looks like another novel. It doesn't say anything on the front about it being not a novel. And I start reading it and it's not a novel. It is, in fact, the Dark Sword Adventures role-playing game. Now, the funny thing is, I don't think that I still have this book anywhere, because I literally never understood it well enough to play it. I understood the concept of, like, creating a location and, like, running people through an adventure, but the mechanics are, like, were so obscure that with no context on, like, what a role-playing game was, I literally had no idea what they were talking about. And it wasn't until college, like, 6 or 7 years later, that I encountered how a role-playing game actually functioned. So that's mine. Someday I'm going to go back and get it, because it is like my first experience with it and it's pretty cool. But it's like a 2d10 weird hand signal system. I don't even know. I don't even remember. I had to go look it up.
Yeah, I had that book as well. It's been too long since I've seen it. I do remember thinking, man, this is kind of strange, but I don't remember, because the hand signals were like, if you don't have dice, you can use these hand signals and do some math based off of this weird sign language thing to determine a number between 1 and 10. It was odd.
Yeah,
that's really weird.
It basically now just left me baffled.
Now I want to know what the hand signals were.
I don't know. We'd have to go find a copy of the book, I'm sure, that Amazon will provide.
Right. Yeah, it's like the players and the game masters are flashing gang symbols at each other and doing math.
Right. Anyway.
So mine was the first edition book of Shadowrun. One of my friends I gamed with at the time showed up with that book, and I had only ever played D&D up to that point. And he showed up with that book and that that Elmore cover with the characters trying to hack into some sort of ATM looking thing with people coming up behind on motorcycles shooting at them. I'm just like, I have no idea what this is, but I totally want to play this game. It took about 2 years before I was actually able to play Shadowrun, though, because the guy who bought the book didn't want to run it because it wasn't D&D, though.
Oh, no. He's missing out.
I totally just looked at my bookshelf and I still have Dark Sword Adventures, so I know what I'm doing today.
Awesome.
What?
You're going to have to tell us about the gang signs some...
Well, like, no, yeah. Look at the... It looks... It's very, like...
It looks like a novel.
It looks like
it does.
It's like the same size and shape as a novel. It does not look like a game book. It's not even like, you know, initially you said paperback and I thought, oh, it's digest sized. No, it's a paperback.
Literally, the reason I didn't realize I still had it is because it was shelved with my Dark Sword books and it just blends in. It just looks like it's part of the series. Sorry, that was an exciting moment while Ange was talking. I just looked over and was like, holy cow! Anyway.
So let's move on to our main topic. The main topic is going to be figuring out how to run games from the book alone. You've never played it before. You've never run it. You've never played it. And now you're going to try and run it. JT, you originally suggested this topic. What inspired you to bring this one up?
I think the reason I brought it up is because this is how I've learned almost every role-playing game I've played, with a few exceptions where I stepped into an existing group and they were playing a game I didn't know. So obviously, you know, I learned from them through the play experience. But I'm usually the game master. I'm usually the one referencing another article of mine. I'm usually the one with the ooh shiny syndrome. So I'm the guy showing up to the table with the, hey guys, look what I bought last week. Let's play this tonight. I try to limit that somewhat because it aggravates my players. But I'm the guy bringing the new to the table. So for me to bring it to the table, I have to know the game so I can teach the game, because you can't really teach a game you don't know. And so that's kind of why I brought this up, is because this is kind of my norm. This is what I do, is I acquire new games. I read the books. I study the books. I go through the character creation process a handful of times, because really that teaches you a lot about the game, is making the characters. I'll go through mock combats. I'll set up minis on my desk here. No like grid or anything, just so I can have a visual reference as to where they're at in relation to each other. And I'll run little mini combats and go from there. But that's why I brought this up, because I seem to be the outlier. A lot of people learn from others. I tend to be the one teaching to others.
Yeah, I know. I tend to feel more confident bringing a game to the table if I've played it at least once. If I've never played it before, then bringing it to the table it's tough. It's nerve-wracking.
It is. And I don't mind bringing it to people I'm accustomed to playing with, because that's one less new thing at the table.
Right.
But if I were to run, I don't know, like a con game for a system I've never run before, I don't know if I could do that, because then it's all new people, it's all new game, it's all new personalities. That's a lot of new all at once, and I don't think I'd want to do that.
I know the couple of times where I've gotten the bright idea to run a con game for a game system I was not comfortable with, like I haven't spent a lot of time running it before. What I made sure I did was run like a home playtest with my local gamers that I know I can trust to at least do that first game. I did that with... last year, 2017, I brought a Bubblegum Shoe game to Origins, kind of based off of Stranger Things, and I had never run Bubblegum Shoe before. So I still ran Bubblegum Shoe wrong. Like, I got the mechanic, like the way the mechanic is supposed to work, I kind of got it mixed up in my head. So those first couple of games were a little like, not really great representations of how the system works, but then I figured it out, and the players still had fun with the scenario and stuff like that. And then this year I got it into my head that I wanted to run Dresden Accelerated, so I brought Dresden Accelerated to Origins, and I had no idea what I was doing with that game either, but I still ran my playtest beforehand, so I at least knew the scenario and could fake my way through the mechanics.
Excellent.
I do a lot of faking my way through mechanics. I do a lot of faking my way through mechanics because learning new games all the time to run on a podcast is actually kind of a tall order, which is why I now bring in other people to run their games for us, because I don't always feel like I'm going to do them justice, because there is that thing where you're like, someone just handed me a game and I'm going to run it. And for me, usually the first time I'm running that game is also the time that we're recording that game. Like, I don't get a practice. I don't get a trial run, right? Like, it is right into the fire. Like, there are some that I don't think that anything actually got played wrong in terms of the rules, really. But I know that I was super shaky on, like, how things worked. But it's recorded and it's out there for everyone to hear now.
Were you the one that ran the Headspace game?
Yes. But I had run Headspace before. But the first time I ran Headspace from a playtest document that was not finalized. And I ran it for the first time at a convention as like the second convention game I had ever run in my life. Because apparently I have no sense of self-preservation.
Wow.
I was going to say that I also decided to run Headspace at a con without having ever played it.
Yeah.
And so my research for that was actually listening to your episodes on She's a Super Geek of Headspace.
My episodes of Headspace, when I ran Headspace on She's a Super Geek, it was actually, I think, the third or fourth time. I think it was the third time I had run it. So I was like, it was like mostly settled in my brain. But also, like, things had changed because I had been playing iterations of the playtests, yeah. Right? So there was like that where I was like, oh gosh, well, this part has changed a little bit. Like, did I do the change right? But I think actually the ones that I was most shaky on, I read Call of Cthulhu. I went out for breakfast the morning before I ran that game for Andy and John Arcadian and, oh gosh, I can't remember who else was on that episode. Somebody else fantastic. I just remember John because he had a pencil in his mouth. But so I literally read... Like, I literally read that book sitting at breakfast, like, an hour before I ran the game.
Wow.
And I'm pretty sure I got it right because it's a pretty straightforward system. But I also didn't have a lot of time to, like, process or, like, think about how those rules were going to work in various scenarios or anything like that. So that's, like, one of those games that I look back on and every, like, people tend to be like, that was awesome. And the people who played in it were like, that was great. And I'm like... Boy, that's like some GMing that I wouldn't necessarily be like real proud to put out there like in my head, right? Versus like, I think what actually went out is probably fine. But there's that moment where you just like, you take the content from the book and there's sort of knowing the content is from the book, but then there's knowing how it sort of interacts with the world that you're creating and when players take actions like beyond just like, okay, this is what you roll, like, how do I use that as a GM to make sure that my roles are interesting? And how do I use that as a GM to, like, move the story along versus, like, okay, like, you're doing a thing, so I'm going to make you roll for everything or, like, any of that kind of stuff. Like, I feel like there is a part that's really difficult to pick up from the book frequently that is sort of that, like, how do you create a table culture around this game that, like, always is moving you in the direction you want to go. Because I don't know how you write that down. Like, I don't know how, right, as a person designing games, you would even verbalize that.
Well, I was thinking about this when you mentioned, you know, your Dark Swords book.
Yes.
It's like, you had no, like, it's a weird mechanic anyway, and then you had absolutely no frame of reference game mechanics to begin with.
Yeah.
So it's the... You know, the more gaming you have in your past and your history, the more tools you have to try and interpret what the book is telling you.
Yes.
To do with the game.
Yeah.
But then there's still gang signs for mechanics, so who knows?
I mean, there's still that part. But yep. Yeah, there is knowing when I sit down at the table, like, I know I can run a good story. Can I run it and use these mechanics effectively to support me, or am I going to struggle with them as I do it? Like, is kind of the question nowadays, right?
Right. You actually said something very key there in that, how do we move the story forward? And honestly, if I am blowing the mechanics up and forgetting rules and dropping the ball on, oh, we forgot to add one to this, or uh-huh, nobody really cares, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
yep.
is the story moving forward? Are we having a good time? Did something amazing happen, either because it's something the player did or didn't do? And if after the game session you're flipping through the book and you're like, oh, hey, it actually looks like Bob missed with that fireball and should have fried the party, but instead of the goblins. But you know what?
Oh, well.
We had a good time. We'll get it. Yeah. We'll do better next time.
We'll get it right next time. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get that rule right next time, and we're guaranteed to get a different rule wrong because that's just how gaming works, right? And eventually you get it to where most of the rules are being played correctly and you're close enough. But the key thing you said there was how does the story move forward? That's the most important part in my book.
When I ran Bubblegum Shoe, the mechanic I was screwing up is whether the players say how much they're adding to the role before or after they make the role. And the game is supposed to be a resource management thing. And so the players are supposed to invest their points before they do the role.
Oh, okay.
And the first couple of times I ran it, I was letting them say how much they were spending after the role, which takes a little bit of the tension out of the way the mechanics are supposed to work.
Sure.
But the players didn't really care because they were still doing things in the game, affecting the game world, making decisions and figuring out the mystery, rescuing people and saving the day. So it's like, yeah, I was screwing up the mechanics and I apologize to the makers of Bubblegum Shoe for that. But it's like the players still had a great time.
Right. You still created a good experience for them with that game system. And you know what?
Right.
No one was recording, so the makers of the game will probably never know.
Until now.
Well, and the thing is, too, is once I realized my mistake, I was like, oh, okay. And actually, I had Kevin Lovecraft was one of my players in that second game. And afterwards, he was like, yeah, you're supposed to do this afterwards. But he's like, that was still a lot of fun. So it was like, oh, okay. I know how to fix it now going forward. But, you know, the end goal of running a fun game still happened.
My other funny story is actually Heroine, when I ran Heroine on my podcast, of course, because why should I playtest things? I had never run a Powered by the Apocalypse game before. So
that one was your
that
first
was my
Powered
first
by
Powered by the Apocalypse game, and it's not a normal one, right? Like, so it's like it's grokking sort of the idea of the system itself. And then on top of that, like, it's not one that works in the way that a normal Powered by the Apocalypse, like, sort of standard rules conversion works. So that's also one that I look back and I love that story and I love that game, but like, I don't know how well I did with the rules.
My first Powered by the Apocalypse game was Monster of the Week, and I brought it to a con, and I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, but thank God, one of my players in that game was my friend who had introduced me to Powered by the Apocalypse games, and I was able to, you know, it's like I had him, my roommate Alana, and some random guy as my players, and luckily all three of them were super cool with, like, I have no idea what I'm doing, let's just do this, and like,
it'll be great.
Quietly deferring to my friend Tristan for rules management and direction on certain things.
Yeah. I mean, I think what it came down to for me is that I don't think that I really understood the GM move part very well.
Yeah.
That was like the part that was tricky to kind of wrap my head around. And then maybe not even that, because the idea of how it works is very straightforward, but like implementing it in play feels very mm-hmm. different as a GM, right? Than
yeah.
just being like, you know, here we are in Pathfinder, you did a thing, I just tell you what happens, right? Anyway, so I don't know, but like, it's really interesting. Was that your experience too when you did Monster of the Week, like trying to go from what's on paper?
Like, I actually still have trouble with the GM moves. For the most part, I'm just like, I try and be like, you know, it's the general idea of like a role happens, so now you need to do something to keep the story moving forward.
Yeah.
You have to do something.
Right. Here's a list of things that you can do.
Yeah. And like, they're great, like, you know, jumping off points for GMs, but, you know, some people look at the Powered by the Apocalypse games and they take the GM moves very mechanically serious.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, nah. I'm just going to go in this direction because I think that's what the story needs.
That's, yeah. I mean, that's, yeah.
Sounds like the right call to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are some tips you guys have for people if they're trying to work their way through a game book and bring it to the table, even though they've never played it before?
Oh, man, I've got two big ones. One is if you're reading rules for a game that is similar to something you already know, and I don't necessarily mean mechanics, but just theme and style-wise, you're going to accidentally insert things you already know from different rule sets into the rule set you are currently reading, or you're going to conflate rules. I do this all the time. I will accidentally borrow a Pathfinder rule when I am running D&D 5.0. Because they're so similar, right?
Yes. I actually borrow rules from 3.5 to put in my 5.0 game, and then we go, wait, no, they got rid of that.
And a lot of times, I don't do it on purpose. It's just that's kind of the natural flow and feel of things.
Yeah.
And then in an old group of mine that's unfortunately no longer together because it was a really fun group, just scheduling things happened, right? One player loved to read the rule book as well, which I enjoy because that way I'm not the only person who knows the rules. But he would call me on when I would screw up a rule or conflate a rule. And he wouldn't do that in a challenging or obnoxious kind of way. And he would actually wait till the end of the game session to do it.
He'd be like, good at least.
Yeah. So he knew the when to do it, the how to do it. He's a great friend of mine. So he wasn't upsetting me or anything like that. And he wasn't like, hey, man, you screwed up this rule. He was, oh, by the way, I think this rule reads differently than the way we played it. And so my advice for game masters learning from the book, if you learn it wrong and somebody calls you on it, don't get upset. You know, of course, the player needs to call you on it in a polite manner. But yeah, if you screw up a rule, don't beat yourself up over it. Don't get defensive. Reread the rule. Sit down. Have a conversation about the rule with your group. Maybe at the start of the next session, or if everybody's still at the house or the game table, do it there after the game's over. Figure out what you did wrong. Figure out how to do it better next time, and move on. So that's my two. That's my two big ones.
Yeah,
those are good ones.
So I guess I have two as well. The first one is if this is just a thing that you're doing quickly as a one-off thing, like a one-shot or something, then the thing to remember is that having fun at the table is going to trump the rules, honestly. And I say that as someone who writes rules and likes my rules and I want you to play with them. But if you're having fun at the table and the name of my game is the thing that's making you have fun, then my goal is kind of accomplished, right? So basically, in the same vein as like having discussions about, you know, how much time do you spend flipping through the book in the middle of the session and like all of that kind of stuff, run your story, have a good game. If you get a rule wrong, you can figure it out later, right? Like, so that's my first thing, right? Is like, you know, do your best and just do it. And you can be very straightforward with your players. And I would say that people are generally very understanding in my experience, fortunately, because I do this all the time. And then the other thing that I would say is if it's something complicated that just has a lot of moving pieces that you think that you're going to run enough to invest this time. And one of my favorite ways to distill game information is to make myself cheat sheets. Right.
Oh, yeah.
I love making. So the act of making them forces you to distill the information into a very like compressed and legible form. And then on top of that, then you have the cheat sheet to refer to. You
know, exactly.
Have to flip through the book. So it's like a win from both sides. The game that I have a cheat sheet that I use the most because I run into a lot of conventions and stuff is actually One Last Job, where I literally just have a sheet that says, like, it pretty much has the entire rules for the game because it's a reasonably straightforward game, but like it has everything on it and I had to write it all down. And now I really understand how the game works, right?
I did the same thing for Doctor Who Adventures in Time and Space because I really love the game. I wanted to start running it, but I was having trouble with some of the rules. So I basically sat down and distilled all the important things I needed to keep track of on one sheet. And
yes.
I'm like, oh, this is, I got this game now.
Right,
I got
this one. Oh, like now it makes sense and I can see it all in one place. So yeah, that's one of my favorite things.
One of the things I'll suggest is, JT actually mentioned this earlier in the episode, is make characters.
Mm-hmm.
Go through the character generation, make characters. Even if you're not going to have the players using pre-gens, even if it's a game like a PBTA game where they're going to be kind of filling out playbooks or whatever, go through the characters, understand the tools that your players have in front of them so that you know what they're trying to interact with the game world with. Because I think if you understand what they're using to try and interact with the game world, you'll be better able to accommodate them or roll with them, even if you're still a little shaky on the rules itself.
Yeah.
Tales from the Loop is probably the prime game that I ran without ever having played before, which was hugely nerve-wracking. But having an understanding of how those characters were put together helped me get through running that game a lot better than if I hadn't put those characters together first. So any last things you guys want to add?
No. I think we've covered it pretty well, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get out of here. This show is funded by the Gnome Stew Patreon. You too can become a Patreon backer by following the Patreon link on the Gnome Stew website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. This ad is brought to you by Bookshelves Are Us, because as any gamer will tell you, bookshelf space is at a premium. So unless you want to switch to digital only and have all your gaming resources floating in the cloud, you're going to need some bookshelves. If you're enjoying the Gnomecast, you'll probably like many of the other Misdirected Mark shows. Here's one to check out.
She's a Super Geek is an actual play RPG podcast highlighting women as GMs. And you can join me and Andy every other Tuesday for lots of different RPGs and guests, including some of the ones in our backlist that I talked about today.
Bombshell, she's the best of us.
She was the best of us.
You can find all of us at GnomeStew.com, at GnomeStew on Twitter, and GnomeStew on Facebook. Senda, where else can we find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at IDELLAMITHLYNND. And if that's hard to spell, because I know it is, you can also just find me at SASGeek Podcast. And then there's a link on there so you don't have to spell out my name. And you can find me at SASGeek.com and on my podcast, Pandas Talking Games, and She's a Super Geek.
JT, where can we find you?
I make it pretty easy to find me. Just hit my website, jtevans.net, and upper right corner of every page, you will find links to all my fancy social media, mainly Facebook, a little bit of Twitter, and some Instagram on occasion. So there you go. Hey, Ange, nice. How about you? Where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at orikes13, O-R-I-K-E-S-13, and pretty much hanging out in the Misdirected Mark communities, which God only knows where they're going to be because G+ is going away.
All right.
We're going to talk about that later.
Yeah. I mean, maybe by the time this podcast drops, we'll have a better understanding of where the G+ community is going to move to. And you'll probably hear on one of the other Misdirected Mark shows that updates a little, you know, more timely with their podcast. But we will let you know as soon as we know.
Yeah.
So, do you guys think we avoided the stew this week?
I hope so.
Nah.
It's the weather's getting colder. People want stoop.
Oh, right.
I'm feeling really stringy, though. I'm thinking maybe I'm not good anyway, right?
Gnomecast is hosted by Misdirected Mark Productions, the media arm of Encoded Designs.
Stop laughing! I'm saying words! I'm making outtakes here, it's gold!